From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Multi-instrumentalist Ricky Skaggs has won multiple Grammys and sold millions of albums by staying both true to his roots and finding new ways to express his musical interests. Kappa will bring him to Columbus on December 11th with the Skaggs Family Christmas at the beautiful Palace Theater. I talked to him over the phone about playing and writing music and how bluegrass music was part of his childhood. We even talked about Tiger Woods back when he used to be known for being a golfer. Hello, Ricky Skaggs. Since you have a new solo album out, I'd like to know if playing with your family and friends changes how you play or write music.
Well, it's kind of coming full circle, really. I started out with my folks, my mom and dad, and my dad, bought me a mandolin when I was 5 years old, and he really worked with me, spent time with me, showed me, some chords on the mandolin. So it was a wonderful way to grow up in Kentucky, and I got to hear a lot of great music. He turned me on to the Carter family, the Delmore brothers, the Monroe brothers, even before I knew who Bill Monroe was. I was listening to some of their early old music, and so a lot of the people that he really loved a lot, like Jimmy Rogers and people like that, he loved those artists and imparted a love into me for those same people, and so he really shed a lot of interesting type music on me as a young child, and now I look 50 years later. I mean, I was 5 years old when he bought me a mandolin, so here I am 55 now, and I'm getting to do the same thing, with my children. My youngest two children, Molly and Luke, they're 20 and 25. They'll be with us on our Christmas tour when we come to Columbus, so we're excited about it, and we love working with family. We have the Whites, which is my extended family, with Sharon, my wife, her dad Buck, and her sister Cheryl. They travel with us on the Christmas shows, and then Cheryl's daughter Rachel comes with us as well. So it really is a generational thing with our family and with our children and of course with Buck, it's his grandchildren. So it's a great thing.
How do you write bluegrass music and keep true to its traditions and roots and feelings and yet extend it into new and different areas?
Well, lyrically, I'm pretty lost. I'm not much of a lyricist, but I do arrange and produce and write a lot of melodies. And this instrumental CD that we did a couple of years ago, that won a Grammy, I got to write all the tunes on that. Every song was written by myself, and some of the tunes the guys in my band hadn't even heard them, and some of them, we'd played at sound checks and rehearsals and that kind of stuff, just kind of fooling around. But when we got in the studio, sometimes they were hearing them for the very first time, and I'm kind of glad we did, because a lot of the solos that came out of them was just first draft solos, first draft impressions of how they would treat that song, instead of really working on it for months, and then getting in the studio and it not being exciting and fresh. They were kind of facing it the very first time, so I loved that about this record. But as far as what I do to try to extend and promote the genre of bluegrass, my background in music, here again goes back, to things that my dad showed me, and music that he turned me on to. And the thing that I loved about my dad is he wasn't just a bluegrass guy and nothing else. I mean, it's like, he grew up at a time before there was a thing even called bluegrass. So he was pulling from all kinds of different music that he loved and that he thought was cool. And so that really gave me an open mind to, you know, to hear things like the Beatles and, you know, in the 60s when I was a kid and was growing up. My older sister, you know, she had the Beatles going in one room of the house, and my mom and dad would have the Stanley Brothers going on in one room of the other room. And I used to tease people. I'd say I would stand in the middle and listen to, you know, to both and could enjoy both and love both and see where, you know, many people would say where two worlds collide, but I, you know, I could hear things that were akin to both, you know. So I play what I love, and I play what comes to me, and I try, unless I'm doing this last Grammy record that we won for was called Honoring the Fathers of Bluegrass, 1946 and 47. Mm-hmm. And the 2 years that Bill Monroe had Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs in his band, they were the ones that really helped create the music, the sound of the music. And so unless we're trying to do something really, really traditional just in order to make a point and to show the next generation what the old music was like, you know, in hopes that they would go back and find it and go back and research it for themselves. If I was going in to start a brand new bluegrass record, I probably wouldn't, you know, do something real, real traditional always. I mean, you know, I'd probably throw something, you know, I've got to throw a Stanley Brother or Bill Monroe or Flatt and Scruggs song of some sort in there just because I love that music so much. But I'd probably be trying to find songs from, you know, Nashville songwriters and trying to do it in a way where, you know, it's now, but it's yesterday, but it's tomorrow, you know. So I think you just have to really keep an open mind to that, you know, and because if you don't, why, you know, you'll just become stale, you know.
Does playing the songs you've written frequently on stage change how you play them? Do you play them with just a melody and improvise, or do you have a really set and firm idea of what the songs should sound like every night? I'm a fairly untalented musician, so I always have to play just what is written.
Well, one thing, you know, about bluegrass is that the musicianship in bluegrass is so good, and the level of these musicians are so good, it would be like taking Tiger Woods out cold and telling him to hit a golf ball. He's going to knock it, you know, to the moon, you know, his first try, even though he's never maybe played that course before. He's just going to have a sense of knowing where the hole is. He's going to have a sense of knowing how to hit the ball, you know, and even though he's, like I said, he hasn't played that course because he's Tiger Woods. And I think quality comes with quantity of work and time and experience and getting good at your instrument. And, you know, bluegrass is a music that is played off the heart. We play by ear. I mean, you know, some of us read. I don't really read music per se. My kids can. My daughter especially. She has a degree in composition and theory, but you know, I can't look at a piece of sheet music and tell you anything about it. Only thing I can tell you is I can't read it. But my band, there's guys in my band that can read some music, but they read chord charts. You know, they have a number system here in Nashville that they play by numbers instead of chords. You know, that way, if you're in a different key, the numbers still apply. You know. Not like, you know, if you have to, you know, read a chord chart, then you're always having to figure out, you know, where B flat or B9 or, you know, something like that, A flat is, and you don't, you know, but if you're reading a numbers chart, then you know, it's much, much easier, makes more sense. But you know, with bluegrass, it's a lot like jazz. I mean, maybe just that's easier way to explain it. People, a lot of people play jazz, kind of, you know, they're great musicians and they practice but they're always ready. They're always on standby, you know. And when it comes time to you get three or four guys together, they're not sitting there reading sheet music, playing jazz. You're there playing, you know, and playing off of each other. And that's the thing I love about bluegrass music.
Well, thank you very much, Ricky Skaggs, and we look forward to the concert on December 11th.
Great. Well, we appreciate it. We're looking forward to it. It's going to be a great night. We're going to have some beautiful string players that'll come and play with us, so it'll be very, very nice. Acoustic music with strings. What a concept. Thanks a lot.
To see the Skaggs Family Christmas, contact the Columbus Association for Performing Arts at kappa.com. And in the spirit of the season, I donated 99 cents to the Apple Store so we could both listen to The Little Drummer Boy performed by the Skaggs Family. Stick around for pastor author Rob Bell just after this song. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Pastor and best-selling author Rob Bell will be in Columbus this week as well on Thursday, December 10th, on his Drops Like Stars World Tour at the Palace Theater. It's billed as A Few Thoughts on Creativity and Suffering, and the talk will cover his coffee table book, A Visual Commentary, he calls it. He averages 50,000 downloads per week, so my interest in his views lies not only in his writing, but also in his church's use of new media. Here, for example, is an excerpt from a recent podcast of his where he introduces a guest to his church.
First off, Cyprian, your last name, Nikiri Yumwami. How am I doing, by the way, on that?
Yumwami.
Yeah, like I said. Yeah, there we go.
Can you pronounce Nki?
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 Well, you have a key and you put a nene before a key. It is Nki.
Nki.
Nkiri Yumwami.
Nki.
Well, I understand. My name is a full sentence, and it means myself and all my belongings. We belong to the King.
So
myself and my belongings, all together, we belong to the King.
So, when you meet someone on the street and they ask you your name, what you respond to them is, well, my name is Cyprian, myself and all of my belongings and all together belong to the King.
Yes.
It's like your name.
Yeah, in Kinyarwanda, yes.
Oh, our names are so boring. I got Bell and you have like a paragraph. That's awesome.
So tell me, Rob Bell, what is the difference between writing a book like Drops Like Stars and something that you're more familiar with, say, writing your sermons?
Actually, everything that I create, it starts, all of the content, it sort of comes over time, and then generally things announce themselves right away. So some things are clearly a sermon, other things are a book, some things are a tour in a book, some things are a film. So from the beginning for me, it was always about creating fresh content that was compelling to me and hopefully was compelling to other people. And sermons are a blast, but I enjoy it all. So it all is a great joy to share with people.
Okay. Because I noticed that you were talking about in an interview about sermons and having high content. And I'm curious how that came about for you. What's the impetus behind that, and does that fuel you as a writer?
Yeah, I'm very curious. I find the world fascinating. So sometimes I think, like, for me, what life for me is like a big hunt or an exploration or a discovery. And so whether it's art theory or quantum physics or economics, or I find the world and I find people infinitely interesting. And so my work, it actually starts there. And then over time, connections begin to be made. And I think to myself, you know what, that could be a book. Or I think other people might find that interesting. And so sometimes I feel like I'm just hunting around, finding things, and then sharing them with people and saying, what do you think about this? I think this is pretty amazing. That's kind of how I see it, actually. So there's a whole bunch of books I'm working on and films, and there's always a bunch of things going on that have my interest.
Okay. Well, and I've noticed that on your page, you've got Facebook postings, you've got a Twitter feed. How did you get into new media? It seems like a real area of growth, and not necessarily one that I've seen a lot of sort of older style religious-based organizations being so involved in.
Well, a lot of that's my brother. He was the one who was like, hey, you should think about Twitter. So I would be the first to say I'm always a couple steps behind. you know what I mean? Like, my friends would laugh if they thought of me as being in any way, like, you know what I mean, on the fresh edge of social media. But and somebody even runs all the Facebook stuff. I don't even know how to get on that. I don't know how to. Someone does all that for me.
Okay.
I mean, in the old world, you would come up with something to say, and then they would have to come up with a package for it, and 9 months or 12 months later, people could go to a store and buy it on a shelf, and now you can type away, and it can be all over the world in 5 minutes. And that's a significant shift in the way that we learn and connect with each other. I find it interesting.
And I notice your Twitter feed is the real Rob Bell. Did you have some fake Rob Bells running around?
Yeah, I actually, because I'd never done anything with Twitter, and I started hearing about a couple of imposters, one of whom had 9,000 followers.
Oh, man.
And was intentionally sending people messages and posting things that are clearly not something that I would be sending. And so that started to become a bit of an issue. And apparently somebody was posting links under my name to things that, like, hey, you really should check this out, stuff that I would never want people to come across, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
Actually, the real Rob Bell was we had to start it in order to kind of provide an alternative to the imposters.
Okay.
That's a really, that's a violating thing, to say the least.
Yeah. You're not the first author that I've talked to. The real John Green I talked to not that long ago, and he's done the same thing. A musician that I like has got somebody doing that as well on Twitter, so it's an interesting thing.
It's like at first it's funny until they have 9,000 followers, and then it's not as funny.
Well, tell me about Wheaton College. How were you as a student writer? What got you into writing and communications that you're doing now?
Well, I was a total slacker in college. I was not a terribly good student. In fact, a couple years ago, I was in the area, and I went into the admissions office and asked if I could have a copy of my transcript, and they gave it to me, and I got a B in tennis. So, I mean, I was pretty undisciplined, unfocused, restless sort of student. My friends and I had a band, and there was a whole, those years that I was at Wheaton, there was an explosion, and I don't know what it's like since, there was an explosion of creativity. So there were, I had roommates who had a comedy troupe and an improv group. There were some really good, Funk and Herod were a folk singing group that went on to do all sorts of things, and a band called All Star United came out of there, and it was a really, really dynamic, sort of fertile, creative environment. And I did do some writing for the school paper, really, really random stuff. And I did dabble in some writing, very absurd, sort of surrealistic stuff. And I haven't thought of that, but I probably around there. But then I didn't do anything with writing for years and years. It wasn't until maybe 5 years ago that I actually sat down to a blank screen and thought I'd write a book.
So that's a fundamentally different act for you than doing a sermon.
Yeah, and I find it fascinating. Like, when I wrote the Drops Like Stars book, and then we're doing this tour where I kind of do like a two-hour live version of the book, I essentially had to start over And that took me a while to realize, because I had some of my sermons transcripted, and it was awful. I would read it and think, this is total rubbish. And essentially, content, I have learned, if you're going to, you have to be true to the particular form that you are working in. So if you are writing, you can't just talk and record it and then type it up and think you have a book. What you have at that point is a transcript of a talk, and that's a fundamentally different thing. I think it's the reason why live albums don't sell as much as the studio album, even though it's the same songs, you know what I mean, played by the same people. It's a secondary medium. It's a recording of an event, but the event was the primary medium. And so, like with books, things that I've talked about, like in our church, and then written a book with some of that same content, I have to start all over. There's no shortcut to sitting there with a blank screen and trying to figure out, how do these ideas work in this medium? And that's just plain hard work, and there are no shortcuts to that.
I read in an interview you said that you were aggressively nonpartisan. And I thought that was a curious phrase. And how do you write with something like that in mind? Does it constrain your views? Do you, you know, have there been times you think, I'd like to write about, say, this content, but you realize that it's straying into an area that you don't want to do for some, you know, for one reason or another?
Actually, no, because I think that topics, I have no problem with certain topics. You just know, in our particular culture, unfortunately, a good number of topics have a sort of politicized dimension to them, that when there's any sort of spiritual, religious thing involved, that can become quite tricky to articulate an issue without having people assume that you have been, you know, co-opted by such and such a group. But no, actually I don't. Partly with a book, you're always aware that the book will be around for years. You know what I mean? So when I write, mm-hmm. I'm always cognizant of whatever I'm about to mention here. People in 10 years could have no idea what I'm talking about. Or this whole thing could have gone a totally different direction, and it will date it. So actually with the writing especially, I try and always ask, will this make sense in 10 years? Will this make sense in 20? What's the true thing here that transcends whatever the specific discussion is going on today? And that's been a very liberating thing.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for talking to us today, Rob Bell, and we will look forward to your visiting Columbus.
All right.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you again for listening to The Ohio State University's Writers Talk. We originate from the New Media Program at the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing, so you can find us on iTunes and YouTube, as well as our website at writerstalk.org, or even, what the heck, facebook.com/writerstalk. Come on out and visit us. There you can peruse our collection of author interviews, or even decide to join our new CSTW book club with OSU professor Aaron McGraw's book, The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard. Join us next time for podcaster and author Mignon Fogarty, a.k.a. Grammar Girl, who will help us work out our issues with lie, lay, and affect, effect. We'll be on our best behavior, grammatically speaking, the next time we talk to you here on WCRS. From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at Ohio State University, this is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing. Here's a little more Little Drummer Boy to carry us out.
I'm a poor boy tuba, rum-pum-pum-pum. I have no gift to bring, ba-rum-pum-pum-pum.